Hello. So what I wanted to talk about now after the break is matching. So I want to look at matching in two flavors. One is matching one-to-one or one-to-n for two-group studies. And the other is matching in three-group studies. And the three-group work was largely work that came out of people kept coming to us and saying, I have three treatment groups or four treatment groups or five treatment groups I want to study. How do I do that? We looked at some ways of doing matching in three-group studies, and we have a recent paper in Epidemiology about that. But what I wanted to start with was matching in two-group studies. And going way back, if you can remember back to the slide with the tree on it, there were about five or six different ways of working with propensity scores. Matching was one of those ways. I think it's an interesting way. I think it's a way that's very applicable to a lot of the types of research that we do, and I think applicable to the kinds of research done in this group, but not the only way. But I think it's the most it's probably the most technically intricate way of dealing with the data. So I wanted to dive into some matching details about how the matching is done and what different approaches to matching will get you, and use that to close out our time here. Can you tell me what time we're going until? It's 10:40 right now. I just want to make sure I'm not running. 11:30, okay. All right. And that... Oh, in the articles, okay. So let's, the schedule had talk and then articles. I think maybe we can do talk and articles kind of at the same time because they're very much interrelated. So, but before we get into that, let's talk about beyond one-to-one propensity score matching in two-group studies. So I guess before we do beyond one-to-one matching, we should do one-to-one matching. So one-to-one matching is, as we looked at with the Duragesic and long-acting opioid example, where you take one treated patient and find one untreated patient or comparator patient to match that person to. And how do you do that? There's a number of different ways of doing that. Peter Austin in Toronto has done a lot of work on looking at different ways of matching and has published a number of really good articles on that. The most common way that I've seen done is using this Parsons greedy matching algorithm, which is a SAS macro that you can download, written by, I think it was published in the SAS user groups, written by Parsons. I think her first name is Leslie, although don't quote me on that. And if you're here, I apologize. and what that does is it finds patients, it takes your treated patient, and it finds an untreated patient with, say, eight-digit equivalent of propensity score. So it looks at the treated patient's propensity score, finds an untreated patient propensity score with an eight-digit equivalence. If it can't do that, it goes on to the next one and does all the eights, then it tries all the sevens, then it tries all the sixes, then the fives, the fours, the threes, the twos, and the ones. So you start with the very best matches and you move down to kind of the relatively poorest of the matches, and you end up with patients who are matched within, say, 0.05 either way, because you're matching down to the first digit. So in the end, at the very end, you're sweeping up all the patients who have a 0.6. So the propensity, you know, the treated patient is 0.62522. You're finding an untreated patient who has a 0.6 equivalent. So that's the first digit. So it's roughly 0.05 either way. And the objective of two-way matching is to find the nearest patient who matches within a caliper. And again, matching is a very big topic, and there's lots of different ways of doing it, but I'm just talking about the most common way that it's done in epidemiology. So the greedy matching algorithm, the Parsons greedy matching algorithm, is an approximation for finding patients who are untreated patients closest to a treated patient with a caliper of about 0.05 on the natural scale, not the Logit scale. That's nice, but really what you're trying to do is not do an approximation, but do the real thing, and you want to be able to do it quickly. So we've published something in our Pharmacoepi toolbox. This is the same toolbox that the HDPS is in for doing not an approximation, but unapproximated, real two-way matching with a caliper, and it takes about a second or so to run. So it's really quite fast. I think, again, sort of going back to computing, for a long time there were a lot of approximations of way of doing things because the computing wasn't there. Well, now the computing is there, and even with minimal computing, you can get a real match very, very quickly. So I would not recommend using the greedy matching one-to-one if other choices are available. But we're not really talking about one-to-one matching. I think what's more interesting is when we did that opioids and duragesic example, remember that we lost about three-quarters of our our opioid patients, because there were a lot more opioid patients at the beginning than there were duragesic patients. And a lot of people look at that and say, you're wasting data. Data are precious. Why are you throwing data away when you don't have to? So one way of not throwing data away is to do an n-to-1 match, a variable, a 2-to-1 match, 3-to-1 match, a 4-to-1 match, to be able to sweep up and use all of the data that are available. And if you recall, going back to the opioids and duragesic example, we weren't sure whether we were losing those 3/4 of the patients simply because we only had one treated patient to match them to, or because they fell out of the overlap of the distribution and therefore weren't candidates for match anyway. But if we up that matching ratio, then we can determine which case we're in, which, you know, largely it probably doesn't matter so much, but B, use all the patients that we can possibly use.
In this study, can you tell us now what the outcome was?
For which?
What outcome were you looking at?
I actually don't remember. I think that's right. That's right. But in the true spirit of the propensity score, if you talk to Don Rubin or the propensity score inventors, they say the development of the propensity score should happen without respect to the outcome. You're looking solely at that confounder exposure association, and therefore my brain lapse for what the outcome was. Now, this is an interesting point. If you look at HDPS, what's HDPS doing? Well, it's doing variable selection with respect to an outcome, with respect to the bias. Remember, there was the two arms and that bias formula. So it's, in that sense, not a pure propensity score variable selection technique. I look at it as a very pragmatic propensity score variable selection technique, because in sort of the pure sense, you know what all the confounders are. You know what your range of variables are, and you're trying to choose, do I include X, do I include Y, do I drop this, do I keep that? In the situation we're talking about measuring additional variables, finding more things to move from that unmeasured column into the measured column, and therefore we're not starting with the entire list. We're starting with a partial list and adding to that and trying to figure out what we should add and what we shouldn't add. So in that sense, it's not the traditional propensity score where you quote, lock away the outcome and ignore it in the development of the score, but more of a pragmatic approach where you're considering the outcome for the purposes of finding out what the confounders might be, then locking that outcome away again and doing your selection of variables to include in the propensity score. Okay, but that was a total sidebar. So we did one-to-one matching, but might end-to-one matching be better? So what do you get with end-to-one matching? Well, you get the same precision as with one-to-one, or maybe you end up increasing your precision. So that's good. Adding more information and using more patients is generally considered to be good. However, that comes at the cost, potential cost, of a loss of validity. So by definition, your second matches, for most matching algorithms, your second matches are going to be less good than your first matches. So when you're adding those extra, say, 2/3 or 3/4 of the opioid patients, they're going to be lesser quality matches than those first matches were. So if you're dealing with lesser quality matches, then perhaps you're increasing the bias in your analytic cohort. So you have the potential for increased precision. You also have the potential for increased bias. That's the eternal, bias, precision, internal validity, type trade-off. So that's a question that one has to ask oneself as an investigator, whether you want to do that or not. I think most people, to be honest, would opt to include the extra patients. Because I think it's a little bit, it feels wrong in some way to those of us who, you know, spend our lives collecting data, to throw data away. It also, to reviewers who review papers, you say, well, you lost 2/3 of your patients. You lost 3/4 of your patients. That's weird. And so this is a way of keeping those patients in. But really, there is potentially a cost to validity. And the way you control that cost in matching terms is by controlling the caliper of the match. So by saying that I'm only going to allow matches to be so far apart. So if my propensity score is 0.6 for my treated patient, I'm only going to allow up to a 0.625 or a 0.575. So a controlled distance for my untreated patient or patients, then that's a way of controlling the amount of bias that's introduced by poor quality matches. So some matching algorithms will match everybody that can be matched. And maybe that's not the right way to do it. You want to be able to have the option to leave some people aside, and that's what this matching caliper does. Does that make sense? So if you're going to do one-to-n matching, where you're going to take now one treated patient and put one or more, two, three, four untreated patients or referent patients as matches, you have two different ways of doing it. You can either do it sequentially, where this is what I call everybody gets first before anybody gets seconds. So you match every treated patient to an untreated patient, if possible. Then you go back and you add a second untreated patient to the group, and then a third untreated patient to the group, and then, you know, until you're unable to do anything more. So that's the everybody gets first approach. So the pro here, the pro of this approach is you never starve a treated patient of his best untreated match. So it's not like you're giving one treated patient two really good matches before that second treated patient gets anybody. You never starve that treated patient. So you always guarantee at least a reasonable match for every treated patient. The con is that when you're putting in those second matches, you may have introduced more bias because you've now given a lower quality match than was possible on that second round. So it could have been that the second match for that treated patient would have been the counterfactual here are hard to describe, but that you've used up that patient's best second quality match in giving someone else firsts, and you may have then introduced bias. The other way of doing this one-to-n matching is a parallel approach, where you just give everybody their next best match. Everybody gets their next best match, and if you end up starving a treated patient of a match, so be it. But you've done it at the price of giving. Of creating the best set of matches that you can possibly create among the treated patients that end up being matched. Does that make sense? So those are two reasonable approaches. What does end-to-one matching get you? Well, we ran a big simulation study where we looked at that, and we focused on variable ratio matching because again, when you're doing end-to-one, you can do fixed ratio where, say, every treated patient is going to have a 3-to-1 match or 1-to-3 match. Or you can do variable ratio where you have 1-to-1, 1-to-2, 1-to-3, whatever the data allow. Fixed ratio matching we'll come back to, but that was a poor choice we found in many, many, many circumstances, and therefore it's not something I would virtually ever recommend to do. And looking at 1-to-1, 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 4-to-1 variable ratio matching, just getting to the answer here, we ended up with the same bias in our simulations and lower mean squared error doing 4-to-1 variable ratio matching as compared to 1-to-1 variable ratio matching in a lot of circumstances. The parallel matching where everyone gets their best matches, you're not making sure that everybody gets first before anybody gets seconds, worked better overall than the sequential matching. So if I'm going to do variable ratio matching, I think this 4-to-1 or n-to-1 variable ratio matching is a reasonable thing to do. Now, did the bias change? Not very much. It could have gone down a little. It could have gone up a little bit. Did the precision change? In this case, it changed a decent amount. But I think in a lot of cases, 1-to-1 works okay. But if you want to bump it up to 4-to-1 or 5-to-1 variable ratio with the parallel approach worked well. The off-the-shelf Parsons method doesn't work that well for doing this. So we've put some code on our website that lets you do it and has some SAS macros and our code for doing that. I wanted to find the slide about fixed versus variable ratio matching, but I'm going to assume it's going to come up here. So here's a big problem with variable ratio matching is your table one. Your table one just gets really screwy. And it's a very difficult thing to present in a report or to reviewers. So here's the basic problem. And again, this is like, you know, sometime in the second hour of day one of EPI class. If you're making a table one and you're looking at smoking versus non-smoking on your exposed and unexposed patients, here's four match sets, three of which have one-to-one matches and one of which got a three-to-one match. Even though smoking is now perfectly matched in your data, if you did a table one where you just collapse this, smoking would look completely off. So you have this table one problem, and you have some options for dealing with it, none of which are really excellent. So you can present the table one as is. So the purists would say, if you're going to present your data, present your data. Show the data like it is. And so if you show the data like it is, it looks like you have real imbalance in smoking, 50% of your exposed and 66% of your unexposed. So that just looks bad. You can weight your table one by the number in each match set. So if you weighted this 3-to-1 match, you know, by 1/3, you would end up with the right number. People don't like that because then you say, well, your table one isn't transparent. You did some transformation of your data. You could present a separate table one for each matching stratum. So you have a 1-to-1 match table one, a 2-to-1 match. That's verbose and possibly confusing. And then you're relying on your readers to collapse all the data in their heads. I don't know. You know, there's a price for the precision. And the price is that you have this table one that doesn't really make sense.
Eventually, you have to present this to not very sophisticated people. You have to make decisions on those data. And I think for them, it's very important that table one looks like randomized control.
So then you're stuck with waiting. So, you know, what we ended up doing on the first time we did this, so we took a combination of approaches. We put the real table one in one column, or in two columns, and then a weighted table one just to the right of that to show, like you say, the p-value, you know, where every p is, you know, greater than 0.05, and it looks really nice and balanced. As I said, there's many options here, and none of them are excellent. So analytically speaking, so one of the nice things about matched one-to-one matched data is you can just do two-by-two tables. If you do a 2x2 table with one-to-one match data, you end up with a fully adjusted, unconfounded, hopefully, unbiased answer. You can get your variance using any of the standard methods. You can't do that anymore with variable matched data. You can do it with fixed match data at any ratio, but not with variable match data. But there's plenty of ways of doing that. You can account for the match set using conditional logistic regression for an odds ratio. You can account for strata of match set sizes, so you can do an analysis in your 1-to-1s, an analysis in your 1-to-2s, and you can combine the strata. There's lots of different ways of doing it, and all of them seem to work just fine. I don't know. I try to divide things into things worth thinking carefully about and things not worth thinking carefully. And this, you know, there's pluses and minuses for each analytic option, but they all seem to work out roughly the same way most of the time. When would you ever do fixed ratio matching? So consider 4-to-1 variable ratio matching. So if each treated subject has 4 untreated subjects, and you're doing variable ratio matching, you're able to find 4 untreated subjects, then you end up with the same cohort you would have had you required that there be 4 matches, so a fixed ratio match for each treated patient. But if some treated patients have less than 4 untreated matches, then those treated subjects would just get deleted from a fixed ratio matching approach. Does that make sense? So if you require that everybody have 4, but you can only find 3 for Colin, then Colin gets dropped from the analysis, and you've lost now treated subjects, which you know, most people would consider to be sort of a precious asset in the data. So if untreated subjects greatly outnumber the treated subjects, then you're likely to get a decent result with fixed ratio matching. And fixed ratio matching, you know, all those issues with the table one and the analysis, they all go away. So things are easier with fixed ratio matching. But if you're doing a high matching ratio and you don't have this enormous surplus of untreated subjects to match, then you can end up losing a lot of treated subjects just by that requirement that everyone have, say, 4 or 6 or 8 or 10 matches. And that's just bad news. So much better in that case just to do one-to-one matching and keep as many treated subjects as you possibly can. So I guess that's a long way of saying I would virtually never do 1-to-n or n-to-1 fixed ratio matching. I just don't think it makes that much sense. Okay, so let's turn to the papers for a sec. In particular, there's this Archives in Internal Medicine paper called The Comparative Safety of Analgesics in Older Adults with Arthritis. So this was a paper written by Dan Solomon in our group. And Dan wanted to compare three different treatments for pain. Dan's a rheumatologist for the arthritis patients in the data that we have. Does everyone have this available?
Does anybody need a copy? We only
have a third. Would it help? Should I put it on the screen? I can put it on the screen.
Yeah.
You want me to do that? You want me to put it on the screen? Hang on one sec. Open PDF. All right, now I think if I drag this here, there we go. Okay. Comparative safety of analgesics in older adults with arthritis. So let's just look at the abstract for a sec, and then I want to have a discussion with the group on how to design this study. So we have three groups of patients. We have patients, arthritis patients treated with non-selective NSAIDs, treated with COXIBs, and treated with opioids. And we have about, I think it's 13 outcomes to look at, plus about 6 composite outcomes. Some of the outcomes, if you look at table 3, the outcomes are listed in table 3. So MI, heart failure, stroke, coronary revascularization, bleeding, bowel obstruction, falls, fractures, hepatotoxic effects. These are the individual outcomes, and I think if I remember right, there's 13 of them, grouped into 6 composites, cardiovascular, GI bleeding, fracture, any hospitalized adverse event, any death related to adverse event, and any all-cause mortality. So a complicated study where you have 3 exposure groups, I think it's about 20 outcomes in total, and you want to be able to do a comparison among these 3 groups for this range of outcomes. So where do we go? What do we do? We need a second act icebreaker here.
I can give you the wrong answer.
Sure. So, does anyone want to give it a shot? So we had too many variables to adjust for individually, if I remember right. So you have 3 groups to study. So what's the output of a 3-group study? Say for 1 outcome.
Well, the confounders might not be the same for Parkinson's compared to NSAIDs and brain cells compared to walking.
This is one issue. This is one issue, yes. So he said the confounders may not be the same.
Are not
the same. Yeah, okay, are not the same. So fundamentally, what's the output of a three-group study? So in a two-group study, the output is a risk ratio, an odds ratio. It's a single value because you have one comparison that you can make. In a three-group study, you actually have three comparisons that you can make. You can compare A to B, A to C, or B to C. So you actually have three possibilities for what the outcome might be. So that creates an issue. You also have three now then possibilities of pairwise cohorts that you can look at, or you can look at everybody globally and compare and contrast. So let's step through this a little bit. So you have a problem with so you want a blunt approach to this would be what I call the Boston way. You want three contrasts? Well, do three contrasts. If you want to make these three contrasts, match your A patients to your reference patients and contrast them. Match your B patients to your reference patients and contrast them. And then match A to B and contrast those people. And that would be kind of a pairwise approach. You want three contrasts. Make three contrasts. That'll use the most of your data. Get you, you know, the three answers that you're looking for. But what does that mean when you've done that? Let's say patient one would be a good candidate for treatment A and for the referent treatment. So in this case, because I'm going back and forth here, I sort of skipped the setup. So we have three treatments. I call them treatment A, treatment B, and the referent. So let's say patient one would be a good candidate for treatment A and for the referent patient, but not a good candidate for treatment B. And let's say patient two would be a good candidate for treatment B and for the referent, but not for treatment A. And let's say patients three and on would be good candidates for all three treatments. Do you want to include in your analysis patients one and two? On?
On what your question is.
Okay, good question.
Three treatments together, or is it A versus B? I go back to your slide before. If your question is really whether all three treatments are comparable, then you probably don't want to include them because you don't have equipoise about A and the referent versus B in patients.
So I think it goes back to the title of the paper. So it's the comparative safety of analgesics in older adults with arthritis. So I think what this is implying is you're a physician and you have three treatments you can give to a patient. How do you make the choice among the three treatments? And in that question framework, in that framing of the question, do you include patients one and two?
Put aside the standard treatment and compare them both lenses.
Yeah.
Really,
so that's one way of doing it. So that would be the pairwise approach where you don't make that third comparison between the coxibs and the opioids.
You do two studies.
In this case, Dan wanted to and we as a group wanted to look at the clinical case of having to choose among these three choices for any given patient that walked in. And so in that case, including patients one and two would have probably not been good in this analysis because we're including patients who weren't in equipoise at baseline for all three treatments. So we tried in this paper here, and this is one approach to fixing this problem. Let's do this interactively. If you say you want to include only patients who are in equipoise, how can you accomplish that? You kind of said it. Right, which is a difficult thing to do analytically. So we took to have the propensity score be close for all three treatments. We took sort of a shortcut, which was we matched A to the referent and B to the referent and included in our analysis those the common referent patients who matched to both plus their A and B matches. Does that make sense?
Why don't you just do two studies? Different studies.
Yeah. It's another way of doing it. You end up with, let's say, I don't think it answers the, let me come back to that because I have a slide for that. I don't think it answers the clinical question that Dan was putting forth, which is how do you, given a patient, how do you make a choice among these three treatment options which are all appropriate for that patient? So I don't think the two studies answer that question, and I'll come back to why that is. So what we did in this paper is we looked at the reference treatment, and let's say the reference treatment had a range of propensity scores of 0.21 to 0.88. Treatment A had a range of propensity scores from 0.05 to 0.65, and treatment B had a range of propensity scores from 0.45 to 0.99. So we matched A to the referent, and you get this subset of patients. And we matched B to the referent, and you get this subset of patients. There you go. And if you then include only the referent patients who were part of both the A and the B match, you end up with this subset of patients. And there's a little problem with this diagram. There's a little funniness to it. So for someone who's going to ask me the question afterwards about why the referent, there's a problem with the reference propensity scores. But just trust me, it's in theory correct. you end up with this smaller subgroup of patients who kind of had, quote, common support among the referent groups. These were each patients whom had a common referent match. And in the trial world, this would be equivalent to doing an A versus referent trial and a B versus referent trial and then sort of combining the results, assuming that the inclusion criteria for the two trials that you did were equivalent. Yeah.
Yeah, what is the propensity score in the referent group in this question, this graph?
So
propensity of
A or B?
This is the problem, yeah. It was a simplification. So technically there should be two referent bars, one for the A to referent contrast and one for the B to referent contrast. So there is a problem with this diagram, yes. But let's just assume that the referent propensity scores came out exactly the same in those two contrasts. Then this diagram would be correct. But it's meant to be illustrative, if not technically correct. So if you do this and you end up with this common referent match, have you really achieved a three-way match? So you would expect balance in the covariates in the A to referent match, and you would expect balance in the B to referent match. But would you expect balance if you were to look at your A column and your B column? You know, maybe not. You know, if it's
I would assume it would depend on the propensity score model that they were generated within the same model, like in, especially with HTPS, if they were separate models, you'd have different variables.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so this would be assuming a constant model across the two contrasts here, or the two propensity scores. Do you really get a three-way match? You know, maybe not. This is the clinical interpretation of this. The propensity scores, if the patient didn't get A, then she would get the referent. If the patient didn't get B, she would get the referent. And A isn't really an alternative, clinically speaking, to B. So a doctor is never making the decision between A and B. It's always A a referent or B a referent, but never A or B. So if you want to fix that, maybe there's some other approaches to take. But does it matter? Does it matter? So this was a big question. Do you really care if that's true? So I think if all three treatments have a homogeneous treatment effect across the population that they're prescribed in, and if A is well matched to the referent and B is well matched to the referent, then through transitivity, A should be comparable to B. And this is sort of a classic technique for trial data, where you want to compare two things that were looked at in trials but not head-to-head. You can do this. You can do this kind of transitivity through the trials. But that does assume a homogeneous treatment effect. And if you have treatment effect heterogeneity, where in less simple circumstances when matching is poor due to unmeasured confounding, or very importantly, there's heterogeneity where the tails of the distributions may have different treatment effects than the center of the distribution or vice versa, then all of a sudden this starts to become a difficult thing to work with.
Any patients or sicker patients will get A, the NSAID, and narcotic, or B, and narcotic. Nobody will get A and B.
So we limited the analysis a priori to patients who only got one drug.
Okay.
Yeah, because otherwise that would be very difficult. And in this particular case of COX-IBS opioids and non-selective NSAIDs, there was really good overlap, clinically speaking, among people who get COX-IBS and non-selective NSAIDs. Opioids had a much wider range. So, arthritis patients who got opioids may be getting opioids because they also had surgery and they had some, sort of profound surgical pain. There's a much wider range of reasons that people got opioids than non-selective NSAIDs or COX-IBS, which are largely, I think, clinically speaking, and I'm not a doctor and certainly not a rheumatologist, but much more used in much more similar clinical cases than opioids. So the patients who got opioids, we had to limit to patients who got opioids for similar clinical reasons as they would have gotten non-selective NSAIDs or COX-IBS. So in these less simple circumstances, when you want to do a true three-way head-to-head-to-head match, maybe you can match A to B to reference simultaneously, but you now have this real problem where we're doing propensity score matching. You can match by variable, but we talked about, breaks down pretty quickly. So if you're doing propensity score matching, and you now have three treatment groups, you now have two propensity scores you have to match on. So if you think about it, a propensity score, if you're looking at A to reference, you have a 60% probability of getting treatment A, which implies that you have a 40% probability of getting treatment B. There's two scores there, and we choose to look at one of them because they sum to one, and so they're mathematically bounded. But if you're looking at A to B to referent, there's now three probabilities, probability of A, probability of B, probability of referent. They still sum to one, so now you have two values that are interesting to look at. And now how do you match on two values? It's a difficult thing. So if you recall, the goal of two-way matching is to find patient pairs that finds a set of patients that minimizes the distance between each pair in the resulting cohort and has no pairs of patients that exceed this maximum distance called the caliper. So now with three-group matching, the goal remains exactly the same. You want to minimize the distance, but now instead of a pair, you're looking at a trio, and instead of a line, you're looking at a two-dimensional space where you're trying to do this minimization. And so we use this, in this paper here, the epidemiology paper describes a method that uses an algebraic analog to this, which is a geometric display of this, where now we have red, green, and blue patients. And if we look at these two red patients, this line is the dividing line in terms of distance between them. And so now we can contract our search space and look for blues and greens that are kind of in the vicinity of this line. And that's just kind of an approximation of how it works. But it's a two-dimensional search for matching trios, where now the distance is not the distance along the line, but the distance is now, it's hard to say, if you were to match this red to this green to this blue, the distance would be now the perimeter of the triangle that connects these three patients. So it becomes difficult, and the epidemiology paper describes how it's done. But it really doesn't matter if it doesn't do something helpful epidemiologically. So we present in this paper a number of different simulation circumstances where we want to see what happens to bias and what happens to mean squared error when we do this three-way match as opposed to the diamonds, which is the common referent match, that one with the candy stripes that cascaded down. And we found in the simplest case, this is no treatment effect heterogeneity, similar patients in all three groups, equal numbers of patients in all three groups, no unmeasured confounding, that that the pairwise, which is what you said, which is just do all the contrast that you said you wanted to do, and the three-way match had similar bias and similar mean squared error, and the common referent approach actually increased the bias somewhat as compared to the other two approaches, and also therefore increased the mean squared error a little bit. But the simple case was not the case that we wanted to look at. The simple case was the simple case, where we expected pairwise and three-way to do the same, because we said there's no treatment effect heterogeneity, and we have equal numbers of patients. We can do all these contrasts, and we expect the same answer. What happens in these cases where now there's dissimilar patients in the three treatment groups, meaning the distributions of the propensity scores didn't overlap so well, and in this case, group three far outnumbers groups one and two. In this case, the pairwise did a tad better. Again, the common referent didn't perform all that well, and especially when you're looking at mean squared error. But now introducing treatment effect heterogeneity, where your effect of the treatment differs based on essentially where you are in the propensity score distribution, that's when the three-way started to really help. I'm trying to find the mouse here. It reduced the bias substantially as compared to the pairwise matching, and reduced the mean squared error as compared to the common referent matching. So in the clinical case where you want to describe what happens to patients with equipoise at baseline, the three-way match seemed to make a lot of sense. It makes sense intuitively, certainly. So when you're thinking of creating a cohort that mimics in some way what you would have done with a randomized trial where you'd randomize people to Coxib NSAIDs or opioids, the three-way match is sort of intuitive in that sense. You know, here we are at baseline. We have balance among all the covariates at baseline. We have patients in equipoise, and then we follow them over time to see what happens. The common referent is I feel like an approximation of that, and maybe not quite as intuitive. And the pairwise is intuitive in its own way, but it doesn't necessarily address the equipoise issue at baseline. So I think the three-way gives a nice solution to that issue. And we're working on code for 4, 5, 6, 7-way. Again, this is there's sort of this exponential increase in computing for each step that you go. So we're trying to minimize that and make this efficient and operate in short time. So the three-way match, just for reference, takes about 10 seconds, 15 seconds. It's quick. Four-way takes a couple minutes. Five-way, so we have to fix that. So let's go back to talking about this paper a little bit. So sort of given all this, what do you think is the right approach to take for this question of Coxib's opioids and non-selective NSAIDs with now 16 or 20 different outcomes? Yeah. Cohort design, okay. And how would you... So what would you do after assembling this cohort of, I forget how many papers for patients there were at baseline. It was about 25,000 patients at baseline. What would you do with the data?
So we matched on the reference.
So you would match? I don't know. So unmatched, there's about 25,000 patients. Unmatched, there's about 25,000 patients. So, what next?
So, what to do with the lost patients?
Or what to do, so you have at 25,000 patients who are treated with these three treatments. You want to look. Let's just say at one outcome, say an MI outcome. What analytic approach would you take?
You lost a lot of patients.
Yeah.
One of the big problems is that, this is initiating prescription. Very rarely is she a rheumatoid arthritis patient on a narcotic. So that's a really, I respect that someone is as a rheumatologist. But that's not a very pertinent question. Because you almost never do it. I don't see how I would do it on a patient. To do it as an initial prescription. So it's very strange that this would happen.
Okay.
So what the other one, obviously, is a big question, has been around forever, and of course, as I said, we have done that much along with that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't see the pertinence of it for very long.
But let's for argument's sake grant the pertinence.
Yeah, okay, let's pretend that it's
So I think maybe I'm missing something about the question. Are you saying we have simple but core?
So we have three cohorts.
Yeah.
And the next point is your question about what's next, how we're gonna analyze this.
Yeah. So Dan et al. Took one approach, but certainly wasn't the only choice.
I mean, imagine cohort studies, if you look at the principles, it doesn't distort the doesn't bias the outcomes the way that it does for a matched case control study.
Right.
So some people advocate to ignore matching altogether and just do a straightforward cohort analysis.
Yeah, in my opinion, the only commonality between matching and cohort studies and case control studies is the word matching.
Yeah.
And sort of beyond that, they're totally different beasts.
So you could essentially ignore the fact that you're matched and just analyze them
like any other cohort.
So you would match. Mm-hmm. Is the implication is you would match?
Yeah. We matched already.
Why not
just adjust the score? Who was you were talking. Okay, so you could adjust for the score. So So what's the score? What's your propensity score?
Well, no,
what propensity score are you adjusting for?
A multinomial model.
Okay.
And rather than forcing three patients to be the same, one patient could have a forced adjustment for different patients because they're in a common other model.
So you could do that. You could do this multinomial propensity score model. You come up with three probabilities for each patient. You adjust for two of them. So in your unmatched data, so the data starts unmatched. So 25 trimmed by what?
I guess
it's really hard, really fast. So if you adjusted for propensity score, I think that's not recommended so much with the two-way propensity scores. I don't know if that how that would generalize into the three-way propensity scores. And by the way, this all falls under the heading of generalized propensity score. If you Google generalized propensity score or PubMed it, there's a literature on the generalized propensity score. Adjusting for propensity score tends to work, but it's not sort of the most recommended technique. But that might work just fine here. So Dan et al. Chose to do this common referent match, which worked out okay. There's the three-way match that can be done, but it could have also been deciled by this multinomial propensity score. It could have been adjusted by propensity score. There could have been weighting by these propensity scores. There's a lot of different ways to do it. I think the three-way match makes a lot of sense in this case. I think the weighting tends to not make sense. Which weight do you use? And then, especially in this case where the opioid patients are so different potentially than the other two groups, and if you're up-weighting opioid patients in favor of other patients, it's really unclear sort of what is going to happen if you do that. I think there's some real challenges. And so The common referent approach was inspired by the trial literature, and being able to contrast results from two trials and make an A to B comparison where you didn't actually do that in the trial. And I think it worked well for this paper. I think the three-way match would have also worked well. So I think we're at time here, so I want to make sure not to go over.
So whatever you did, it worked.
It worked. I mean, it
worked well.
I think so. And the proof is in the pudding on this stuff. As you said, looking at table one and seeing if you have balance, that's the most important thing. Now, you hope that you've put everything in your propensity score that you should have put in your propensity score, so that the balance that you see here extends to the unmeasured covariates as well. The reviews of this paper were largely around, did you really capture everything that drives the choice of treatment of opioids versus non-selective NSAIDs or COXIBs? I mean, that's the crux of it. And do you really think that you've adjusted for all the unmeasured confounding in the opioid group? In terms of did you achieve what you set out to achieve with your propensity score, the table one is the proof that you've done that. And the rest is by assumption. And that's the same assumption that we face with any observational study that we do, that we actually measured everything we wanted to measure, and that we actually put everything into the propensity score that we should have put into the propensity score.
Any advice on how many ways you can take this? So there's 3, 4.
You know, I think there's two issues. There's the computational issue, which let's just say is solvable. And then there's the, do you really want to do a 5-way match with equipoise at baseline? And what clinical scenario does that really reflect, where there's sort of a clinician, you know, has no sort of predisposition towards one of these treatment choices? You know, they're all sort of equally reasonable at baseline. That, I think, starts to break down at some point. You know, like you were arguing that it broke down already in the 3-way match. But not being a clinician, I can't really speak to that. But it just seems like, you know, at some number around 3 or 4, maybe 5, that's the limit of how far it should go.
Do we take maybe 3 questions from the audience? And does that sound okay to everyone? Is there any questions?
Just maybe these are not relevant questions, but so we are doing propensity score and to take and reduce the bias. But the same technique, is it possible to use in the survey data?
See what?
Survey data. Like we are using this methodology in the administrative data.
Yeah.
The same technique, can we use for survey data?
Oh, sorry. I don't see why not. I know that there's a lot of nuance to survey data, and I am not an expert in survey data by any means. I can't think of a reason why not. But I know that survey data has nuances to it that I just may not understand.
What second thing is, like, we're using the administrative data to estimate the propensity score. My question is, in the work of, can we generalize our propensity score to the general population, not a sample?
Not recommended.
General population.
Yeah, not recommended. So, in general, a propensity score is meant to describe the population at hand and only the population at hand. And you're trying to fit the best propensity model you can fit within that population, without trying to generalize to other populations, because that would involve interpreting the parameters, that would involve, sort of all these issues of generalizability that we come across in sort of normal types of models. So I think that's probably not a good thing to do, because then you're interpreting the parameters, and you know, we sort of said from the outset that interpreting these parameters doesn't make a lot of sense. You have to deal with model fit issues, not overfitting your model. Really, the idea of the propensity score is to achieve balance in your cohort and only in your cohort. And if it generalizes, great, but I wouldn't seek to do that.
So your point about, you mentioned earlier on about picking new users of drugs, you know, and designing pharmacology studies well taken in, and by limiting the measurement of potential confounders in for incorporation into the propensity score model, you're dealing with the issue of that you're not adjusting for mediators at the same time, etc. But doesn't that limit then the ability of the propensity score to adjust for confounding for outcomes that might happen 3, 4, 5 years down the road after the inception of the core. So you can have adjusted for confounding at the baseline.
Yeah.
But since then, people have diverged and they have acquired immunity.
Yeah, I mean, that's that is a challenge. I wouldn't file that under a propensity score challenge. I would file that under a time-varying confounding challenge, which you know, has its own methods for dealing with. Romain Neugebauer at Kaiser out in California has done some work with time-varying high-dimensional propensity scores, marginal structural models using propensity score HDPS, and that I think would be something to look at. He's that's in the review process right now, and other people have certainly looked at time-varying propensity scores, but really. The propensity score, as I presented it with the new user design, is meant to capture the patient's status at baseline, and then you follow them over time. And the follow-up plan and how you're going to deal with changes in status and changes in treatments and things like that is really something that has to be addressed separate from the propensity score issue.
Yeah,
one
small question.
That's a long way of saying I'm punching on your question.
Propensity scores, all of your examples were in cases where the probability of treatment was somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
We did have a case where we had probability of treatment was 1%.
Yeah.
Cohort. So our propensity scores tended to be all very low.
Yeah.
For both groups. And I guess the real question is, has anybody looked into, you know, issues of trimming where, in fact, the tail over the end is... it's strange comparison between the two groups. There's not a lot of people out there. And in fact, most people are predicted to not get the treatment, even the majority of the treated group. The overwhelming majority of the treated group has a propensity score.
So that just means that so if you sum the two groups and take the average propensity score, that's going to be your prevalence. So you have a low prevalence treatment. That's a challenge. I mean, it's a challenge, especially if you're doing like caliper matching at, you know, like a 0.2 or something like that, and everyone has a propensity score 0.1 anyway. You're just sort of matching everybody. But if the distributions are overlapping and kind of nobody has any distinguishing features, then, you know, you're starting with an unconfounded analysis or a minimally confounded analysis. But that is a challenging situation. I would say that you know, you're in one of two cases there, where either there's very little confounding to start with, or there's confounders that haven't been measured that will really start to distinguish who's being treated and who's not being treated, and that'll push those distributions apart a little bit. But I would file that under yellow flag for let's make sure that everything that should be measured is actually being measured here before continuing with the analysis.
I like yellow flag. That's a good answer. It's better than red flag.
Yeah.
You'd also want to revisit the equipoise question.
Yeah.
You know, if you have 1% of your cohort being treated, probably 90% of your cohort where you don't have equipoise, they're not really eligible in the clinical setting to get treated. So you may want to sort of rejig the cohort, throw a bunch of them out. I mean, if you have good ways of discerning who those people are, you should throw out. You know, trimming the top 90% of the propensity score distribution is really not relevant.
Yeah, or look at the comparator
yeah.
And see whether the comparator is the right comparator in that case.
So I know there are more questions. Maybe if you can catch Jeremy running down the hall, you can get a chance to ask them. But I think we've gone over. I'd just like to once again thank Jeremy for a very interesting talk.
And thank you, Colin, and thank you, everyone, for having me here. I really appreciate that opportunity.
Thank you.